Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Who is ultimately going to pay that candidate back and why? I think voters just don't know the answer to that on Election Day.
A special election candidate loans hundreds of thousands of dollars to his campaign. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, foster children get support in their lawsuit over the state using their Social Security benefits.
So this is money that the parents earned and paid through their paychecks, and that's supposed to be going to the children.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's unique approach to mental health funding is improving the lives of Alaskans who experience behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has a responsibility to generate revenue from its 1 million acres of land and the resources they contain. The trust uses this revenue to help fund statewide programs and initiatives that positively impact trust beneficiaries. To learn more, visit alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The state will rescind Alaska's public health emergency order for COVID-19 on July 1st. In a press conference today, State Health Commissioner Adam Crum said the health department has been working to make sure any COVID-specific tools and systems Alaskans still need are now permanent or sustainable. He said most Alaskans won't feel a major change as a result. The end of the order also means the end of extra SNAP benefits for the more than 50,000 households in the state that receive them. That extra benefit could be anywhere from $100 to more than $1,000, depending on the size of the family. Those benefits will continue through August of this year. The State Health Department will continue to monitor and track COVID-19 cases and report them on a weekly basis. The special election to finish the U.S. House term of the late Congressman Don Young is in its final days. The candidate running the largest campaign is Republican Nick Begich III, who has loaned his campaign $650,000. Thanks to a federal Supreme Court decision last month, Begich can recoup all of that in post-election fundraising. Candidate loans are legal, but ethics watchdogs say when the candidate wins elected office, the payback can look like bribery. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Wealthy candidates in federal races have always been able to give their campaigns unlimited amounts of money. But when they loan the money, University of Missouri professor Kathy Kiley, a campaign finance expert, says it leaves the public in the dark.
Who is ultimately going to pay that candidate back and why? And I think voters just don't know the answer to that on Election Day.
Until May, candidates who lent money to their campaign could get no more than $250,000 repaid later. That rule was imposed to limit the potential for corruption or the appearance of it. But the Supreme Court struck down the limit as unconstitutional. Begich is one of the wealthier candidates in the U.S. House race. He reported income last year of more than $1 million from a software development company he founded, plus more than $100,000 from Earth Pulse Press, a company that publishes his father's theories about government mind control. Professor Kiley, who used to work at the Sunlight Foundation advocating for government transparency, says it's bad enough when successful candidates hold post-election fundraisers to pay off what they owe their consultants or pollsters.
You're hanging out a shingle and saying anybody who's interested in winning friends and influence over here, here's the donation jar.
Kiley says it's a whole new level of troubling when the aim of a debt retirement party is to pay back the candidate who is now a member of Congress.
It's one step short of putting money directly in the pocket of a lawmaker, which in most contexts we would consider a bribe.
The Begich campaign did not respond to 3 emails asking about his campaign loans, including 2 asking if Begich would solicit post-election contributions if he wins. That's the scenario that rings alarm bells at the Campaign Legal Center, one of the groups that filed a brief in the recent Supreme Court case. Saurav Ghosh is the center's director of campaign finance reform.
Because the pitch to potential donors at that point is, you know, I won the election, I'm going to be in office, but I have this large personal loan, which the campaign can repay me. I would love for you to make a contribution to help repay me. It just raises all kinds of very clear corruption concerns.
Begich is not the only candidate in the race who made a large personal loan to his campaign. Nonpartisan Jeff Lowenfels lent his campaign $100,000. Lowenfels says he'll refuse repayment contributions if he wins.
I think it's a little bit disgusting. You know, you're elected, and then, of course, somebody's going to come and try and help you pay your loan back. Gee, they're being awfully nice, aren't they? I mean, it just doesn't feel right. It feels like a bribe.
Lowenfels says he made the loan to jumpstart his campaign. He's relying primarily on radio ads and mailers to get the word out. As of May 22, the end of the reporting period, his personal loan was about two-thirds of his campaign total. Nick Begich's campaign report shows his loan comprises slightly more than half of his total, and he's also made a contribution of $23,000. His major expenses include ads, strategic advising, and payroll. In terms of contributions from others, Begich is in second place behind rival Republican Sarah Palin. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A national nonprofit that helps foster youth is supporting an appeal from a group of Alaska children filed late last year over the state using their Social Security benefits. In 2019, a Superior Court judge ruled against foster youth in a case where the State Office of Children's Services had been applying for Social Security benefits on behalf of foster children who were entitled to the money due to a deceased parent or guardian. Amy Harfeld is National Policy Director for the San Diego-based Children's Advocacy Institute.
What, you know, Alaska was doing, similar to many other states, is automatically screening all kids who come into foster care to see if they're eligible for any benefit. And when they do this, they don't tell the child or their attorney or guardian ad litem that they're doing that.
The state was putting that money into its OCS budget. Clinton Bennett, a spokesperson for Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services, said the agency, like parents, uses the benefits to pay for the children's daily expenses, such as shelter and food, rather than just giving them cash. The judge ruled against the foster youth's request to be reimbursed for money the state took from their benefits. However, the judge did rule that the state had to notify children and their lawyers when they were applying for these benefits, a ruling the state is currently appealing. In an amicus brief filed last month, Harfeld voiced support for an appeal from the plaintiffs that argued the state should foot the bill for caring for foster kids and the children should receive all of the Social Security benefits they're entitled to when they leave the foster care system.
So this is money that the parents earned and paid through their paychecks, and that's supposed to be going to the children.
Harfeld says she hopes the appeal will be addressed at some point this summer. She says the plaintiffs are set to file another legal brief in late July in support of the court's ruling that the state must notify foster children and their attorneys when they apply for Social Security on their behalf. Firefighters contained a wildfire in the Eureka area of Interior Alaska over the weekend. Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ibsen says the Omega Creek fire started Saturday at a mining operation.
And quickly went into the wildlands, neighboring wildlands. So we had some smoke jumpers respond to that and quickly get around it. Smoke jumpers and two fire bosses, water scooping fire bosses that quickly got around of it and put the kibosh on it.
Ibsen says the fire, located about 77 miles northwest of Fairbanks off the Elliott Highway, was corralled at about 4 acres. She says the blaze destroyed a mine outbuilding where the flames originated.
The mining operation wasn't actually occupied at the time, meaning that there was nobody home, so it's still to be determined what exactly started that fire.
Ibsen says the fire was spotted by someone driving the Elliott Highway. Meanwhile, there were over 4,000 lightning strikes detected Saturday and Sunday statewide. Ibsen says the strikes were south of the Alaska Range and concentrated in southwest Alaska.
The Bristol Bay area in between Dillingham and Bethel. So we've had a lot of fires over the weekend pop up there, including one in near King Salmon that has grown considerably.
The Contact Creek fire is burning in a limited protection area inside Katmai National Park and is not being fought. But two other Western Alaska wildfires were staffed as of yesterday. Ipsen says some rain is forecast for that part of the state, but the interior is expected to remain warm, dry, and windy.
And I think people have been taking note of that and have been pretty mindful. And thankfully, we haven't had too many fires erupt. And part of that is because we haven't had the lightning up here, too.
Ipsen says Alaska's wildfire fighting capability has been bolstered by 20 smoke jumpers from the lower 48, and response agencies are looking into bringing in additional firefighting aircraft. Burn permits are suspended in the Kenai, Matsu, Fairbanks, Delta, Tok, and Valdez Copper River areas. A burn ban remains in effect for Anchorage. Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly wants answers from the mayor about working conditions at the library.
I have never seen so many municipal employees come forward with similar complaints.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People who smoke or have smoking-related conditions like lung and heart disease are more likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19. Not using any tobacco or e-cigarette products is one of the best ways to keep your immune system strong, ready to fight all kinds of viruses. If you decide to quit, help is available. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or text READY to 200-400 to get the support you need to quit for good. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
A climber has died after collapsing while attempting to summit Denali. The National Park Service said 48-year-old Fernando Berman of Stockton, New Jersey, collapsed Friday at an elevation of 19,700 feet while on an attempt to reach the top of the 20,310-foot peak. The Park Service said Berman's guides initiated CPR, but he never regained his pulse. After his death, Berman's body was moved to a plateau and taken down from the mountain by helicopter before being sent to the Alaska Medical Examiner's office. Park Service said the cause of death was unknown, but was consistent with sudden cardiac arrest. The Anchorage Assembly says it wants answers from Mayor Dave Bronson's administration about the work environment and management decisions at the Anchorage Library under its acting director, Judy Elledge. The calls for information follow recent news stories about alleged offensive comments by Elledge, plus concerns about staffing shortages and a recent decision to close the library on Sundays. The Assembly invited the Bronson administration to a meeting about the concerns on Friday, but the administration said it was not available. Instead, the Assembly heard from library advisory board members and former library staff about unfilled staff jobs and concerns about Elledge's leadership. They also heard from Anchorage Ombudsman Daryl Hess. He says he's gotten complaints from more than a half dozen library staff since March.
In 10 years and dealing with 15,000 people, I have never seen so many municipal employees in one facility of one department come forward with similar complaints.
Hess said the first two employees who contacted him told him they were not comfortable going to human resources, the normal channel for workplace complaints, saying the director is, quote, very politically vocal and active, unquote. Assembly Chair Suzanne LaFrance sent a letter on Thursday to the Bronson administration asking for answers to more than a dozen questions about the library management. Amy Domboski, the city manager, responded the same day and said she would need more time to answer the questions. The Sitka School Board has offered its informal support for a plan to tax the sale of cannabis products in order to pay for extracurricular activities in the school district. The Sitka Assembly has drafted a ballot proposition to put before voters this fall that would eliminate the municipal sales tax on cannabis and replace it with a slightly higher consumer tax. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, the school board has backed the proposition with one major caveat.
The problem is just a line in the ballot proposition ordinance stating that the money raised by the new tax would be included in the calculation of local support for the schools per state law, where it might have the unintended effect of diverting funding from classrooms into extracurriculars. That's an oversight, according to Assemblymember Rebecca Himshute, who sponsored the ordinance. She cleared things up with the school board at its meeting on June 1st. This money is intended to land outside the state funding formula and directly support student participation in sports and activities.
It's really important to the Assembly, or at least to the three co-sponsors, that these funds be supplemental to the district's existing effort. So our expectation is that the district will continue with current funding levels and will be adding to.
Himshute said that the problem language would be deleted from the draft ordinance with the approval of the rest of the Assembly. Another likely change will be eliminating the highest proposed tax rate of 10% on marijuana and capping it at 8%. Sitka already charges a sales tax, which alternates seasonally between 5 and 6%. Cannabis products would be exempt from the regular sales tax if voters approve the ballot measure. Himshute said this made the new consumer tax easier to bear for the cannabis industry in Sitka.
The three companies we've been talking with, one company has been very supportive. One company has become supportive through the changes that we're making, and we're not really hearing from the third company. And when I say very supportive, they understand the need for activities and targeting, using this as a means to that end is something they're supportive of.
Taxing marijuana is complicated. Outgoing school board president Andrew Hames recalled serving on the Marijuana Advisory Committee in 2016 and learning how excess taxes might make legal cannabis uncompetitive with the existing illegal market.
And at that time, there was so much concern by people who were looking to starting a business at being burdened down with taxes and not being able to, number one, be competitive with the black market, and number two, be sustainable.
Hames said that he was pleased that the Assembly was now pursuing the idea. Funding student activities has been a difficult problem over the last couple of decades. Travel costs are huge, and students and families are asked to both fundraise for activities and pay fees that have grown so large that equity is a serious concern. The school board has explored solutions over the years, formed parent committees without any major breakthroughs. Board member Paul Ryu thought the consumer tax on cannabis products was the first real opportunity in a while.
As much as I hate to see new taxes, I was thinking back to what Mike commented a few months ago about, you know, possibly looking around at the good old days, and we're looking at situations with, you know, rising costs and stagnant, if not declining, revenues. And if we're not working as a community to solve those problems before they reach our doorstep, then they're just going to run us over.
Assemblymember Himshute encouraged board members to speak to the proposed ballot proposition at the Assembly's next meeting on June 14th. She reminded the board that sales tax revenues were on the rise overall in Sitka, and that replacing the sales tax on cannabis with a slightly higher tax to benefit students wouldn't be seen as unfair to the sector.
And we do always have to acknowledge the risk of black market when we increase taxes on this industry. So I guess there's a certain level of faith and trust in Sitkins to do the right thing. There won't be a huge bottom line difference to most people in town who are using marijuana products.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Alaska State Library Talking Book Center has audiobooks and more for children and adults who are unable to read standard print. Learn more at talkingbooks.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Library Network.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
An Iditarod sled dog has been found after disappearing from a race checkpoint 3 months ago and covering nearly 150 miles. The Iditarod Trail Committee said Saturday that musher Sebastian Dos Santos Borges of France had been reunited with Leon. Race officials say Leon was captured in McGrath, more than 120 miles south of the Ruby checkpoint, where the dog had slipped away back in March. While racing the 2022 Iditarod, Dos Santos Borges had dropped Leon and Ruby after arriving at the checkpoint March 12th. Dos Santos Borges scratched later in the race. An Iditarod spokesperson says Leon was found safe and alert, though skinny, and was expected to see a veterinarian before returning with Dos Santos Borges to France. It's been 40 years since the first celebration, which was hosted to celebrate the survival of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. This year, the theme is Celebration 2022, celebrating 10,000 years of cultural survival. Sealaska Heritage Institute is the host of the event. After 2 years in a pandemic, the term survival means even more, says President Kahani Rosita Worrell.
We saw how it was affecting our elders, and so the elders became, you know, kind of a symbol, a critical symbol for us, you know, the survival of our culture.
Juneau's COVID-19 case count has risen in the last 2 weeks, and the city and borough of Juneau no longer manages health risks related to the pandemic. To limit spread during the events, all staff will be tested daily, temperatures will be taken at the door of each event, and masks will be required and enforced by moderators. Worrell says she's expecting around 3,000 people to attend celebration.
Over 40 years, it now is significant for us to gather together to celebrate our culture. But you put that on top of all of these other events where we were not able to gather, and it becomes really important.
Celebration takes place in Juneau, June 8th to the 11th. Bethel and Napaimute Elder B. Kristovich died last week at the age of 83. The Association of Village Council Presidents elected Kristovich as their first woman traditional chief in 2015. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Kristovich spoke with KYUK the day of that historic election.
Women were always left out over the years. The men were the leaders. But over the years, there's been more people, more ladies or women, getting more active, going into active roles as leaders from the villages. And they're still silent, but I think being the first one, it'll show these other younger generation that they can do it.
That day, B. Kristovich shared her vision for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta tribes.
I want them to be united. You know, there's 56 villages, and we're still separated by Yukon, Kuskokwim, and our area. And I think that if we're all united, we'd be so strong, if we could stick together and fight for issues that are very important for our people and our villages, it would work.
Kristovich wanted younger people to lead the region. She resigned as traditional chief after 1 year. Kristovich is Athabascan and a member of the native village of Napaimute. She was born in Napaimute and lived most of her life in Bethel. During her multiple careers, she worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Alaska court system, and the Lower Kuskokwim School District. Her family says Kristovich died in Anchorage at the Alaska Native Medical Center following a long illness. The family will hold a viewing in Anchorage, a Catholic funeral in Bethel, and then a burial for the former traditional chief in Napaimute. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Central Kenai Peninsula is sending a team of athletes to Florida this month for the USA Special Olympics. And on Friday, they got a gold medal-worthy send-off. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more.
Athletes can sometimes get bogged down in the negative self-talk before they compete. That's not a problem for Josh Deli of Soldotna. He knows exactly what he's most looking forward to when he heads to Orlando for the 2022 USA Special Olympics.
Just the souvenirs and getting gold again and telling us we're champions.
I love the optimism and confidence.
That's his bocce partner, Sam Eason of Nanilchik. Eason and Deli are two of the athletes representing the Central Kenai Peninsula and Alaska in the Special Olympics this week. Eason has been volunteering with the Special Olympics for 20 years. He says the Orlando event is a great chance to meet athletes from all across the United States.
And I met so many good people, so we get to meet people around the whole country now involved in Special Olympics, so that's awesome.
Get to see what they do and on our off time and on time, and get to see what we do on our off time and doing our on time and such like that.
As the athletes boarded the first of many flights to Florida from the Kenai Municipal Airport, family and friends from Hope Community Resources gave them a very spirited send-off, complete with colorful good luck banners and a procession of fire trucks. Daryl Megan's mom, Charlissa, is joining Daryl in Orlando.
He qualified, and they called him last year and told him that he made the team if he would accept the honor, and he accepted it, so he's been training all year for this.
Dennis Haas is Deli's guardian. He says Deli and Easton have been keeping up a regimented practice routine in preparation for the games.
Yeah, so I'm pretty proud of them. They've been working pretty hard at it.
He says that emphasis on working hard and on routine are really valuable lessons that come out of the Special Olympics for athletes.
You know, there's only two people going from the Kenai, you know, but they know a lot of the athletes from across the state, you know, by participating in statewide events, you know, so they meet friends from Kodiak and Ketchikan, and yeah.
This is the largest Alaska delegation ever to go to the USA Games.
Sue Pearls is CEO of Special Olympics Alaska. She says they're sending a group of 71, including about 30 athletes and a dozen coaches.
The summer games are mostly at Disney facilities in Orlando, so it'll have a very special and, as they say, magical flavor to it.
Special Olympics athletes usually qualify for the USA Games in regional and then in statewide competitions. But this time around, the statewide games were sidelined due to COVID-19.
So we took their community competitions and qualified athletes through to go to the USA Games.
Deli, who's wearing his qualifying gold medal around his neck at the airport, remembers qualifying for the national competition. He says it didn't come easy.
And we had to fight really, like, tooth and nail and stuff, so we had to really earn it.
He's expecting more tough gameplay, but the Olympics won't be all work and no play. Megan says when he's not swimming, he has other plans.
Disney World.
Disney World?
Uh-huh. New flies.
Is it play when we're not working?
Yeah, playing when we're not
playing when we are working, too.
And if the airport send-off is any indication, there will be a lot of people cheering Deli and Megan on from home. On Friday afternoon, about two dozen fans lined up in the hot summer sun to create an aisle from the terminal to the small plane while Deli and Megan slapped high fives and accepted congratulations. Then they jetted off to Anchorage. They'll be greeted by another procession before beginning the long journey down to Florida and, hopefully, to gold. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Claire Strimple and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Liz Ruskin, Wesley Early, and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, a question, a comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.